But Marcus also had a warning for the Silverchair filmmakers, saying, quote, "They're going to be in trouble if they, like other people, have felt like we can turn this into a big fantasy franchise."
Yeah, I thought it was a bit hypocritical.
Well, I would say I think I'm going to largely defend them here.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world
and can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts
from NarniaWeb.com,
where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis
and keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This is Talking Beasts.
Welcome back to Talking Beasts. I am Glumpuddle.
And I am Rillian.
We kind of have some Silver Chair news to get. Well, not news, but a Silver Chair something.
A Silver Chair discussion. Someone somewhere talked about it, and because they were famous, there's an article about it.
But they're not just famous. They're the original Narnia screenwriters. So I don't know, like, for our listeners, how much do they... I don't know how much you, our listeners, necessarily value their opinion, but it's a very interesting opinion to get nonetheless. As far as we know, the Silver Chair is still on track to begin filming later this year, but we're kind of waiting for more news on that. So we're going to get into that discussion. That'll be fun. Quick reminder... The Prince Caspian Watch Party is going to be on Saturday, May 12th, and we now have a time. That's going to be at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So again, you just log on to NarniaWeb at that time. We'll have a link, and we'll have a way to get your Blu-ray, DVD, or digital file ready for Prince Caspian ready. We'll sync everybody up and hit play at the same time and just discuss it. And me and Jim Fan will be there kind of offering a live commentary and kind of encouraging discussion. And have stump questions ready, because we're going to encourage you guys to throw out live stump questions to us during the commentary.
Are you doing that via the comments on the video itself?
Yeah, well, we're live streaming it on YouTube, so there's a little chat box in there where people can
look
send.
Look at you hosting this episode. I'm so proud of you.
I know.
You're doing such a good job.
Well, I had a really great mentor, and I'll introduce you to him someday.
You should. Maybe we can actually get some talent on this thing.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? We can dream, can't we?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to our main discussion here. So what we have is, in a recent interview with IndieWire, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who are the screenwriters, the primary screenwriters, at least, of the first three Chronicles of Narnia movies, offered some free advice for the Silverchair filmmakers. And some quick background, after leaving Narnia, Marcus and McFeely went on to write some of Marvel Studios movies, including all three Captain America movies, and then recently Avengers Infinity War, which just recently opened, and I haven't seen, so no spoilers, please.
Yeah, me neither.
In the interview, Marcus and McFeely confirmed that they are not involved with the Silver Chair, which we already knew, so David McGee remains the only announced screenwriter on the project, but they did give some tips for the Silver Chair filmmakers, for what it's worth. First off, Marcus supports the decision to make the Silverchair the next movie, calling it, quote, the most cinematic of the remaining books.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, we will get into that. He also said, and he explained why. He also said, quote, it has the sort of quest narrative that would easily become a movie, so that is a good choice, end quote. But Marcus also had a warning for the Silverchair filmmakers, saying, quote, they're going to be in trouble if they, like other people, have felt like we can turn this into a big fantasy franchise because the books are all different and not each one is going to give you the same movie. Marcus also said, quote, you can make a thoughtful movie from each one and it would be great if the people were prepared to do that. It's been interesting watching Narnia Webbers react to this. A few kind of went like Lou the Centaur, Narnia Fan 7, and Throne Warden were kind of like, yeah, totally with you guys. Then there were a few like Skillet Dude and Celtic Laura who kind of went, wait, this is coming from you guys?
It's Celtic Laura.
Oh, so I'll say that again. And then there were a few.
Unless she's a huge Celtics fan, then it's Celtic Laura.
Oh, you're right. Sorry.
I'm just throwing it out there.
Hosting is hard.
I got
Gosh.
Your back, Laura.
You know what? You want to just do this?
No.
I'm kidding. I want to do it. I'm kidding. I want to do it. I want to do it. Don't take me as seriously ever.
Don't worry.
So some people like Skillet Dude and Celtic Laura kind of went, wait a minute. This is coming. The original Narnia screenwriters are warning the next movie filmmakers to not turn it into a big fantasy franchise. Really? This is coming from you guys? So kind of a varied response there. What was your reaction to this?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It was not Marcus and McFeely who... But I'm thinking back to old interviews where people think, you know what we should do? We should make this more like Star Wars or more like Harry Potter. And for a split second, I was trying to remember. I thought, okay, wait, surely not. This is not the same two script writers that were on Voyage of the Dawn Treader and tried to make it the most epicest film, which Prince Caspian you could do that with, and it was a little more forgivable because of it involved battles in the story. But even with Prince Caspian, I thought, okay, just someone here is trying to take the reins from Lord of the Rings, and it just was kind of... Yeah, I thought it was a bit hypocritical.
Well, I would say, but I think I'm going to largely defend them here. I think I did kind of have that knee-jerk reaction initially that, what, it seemed a little hypocritical. But I think we have to think about what they mean by great big fantasy franchise. And I think when we hear that, most people, their initial reaction is, oh, they're talking about add the epic battles and make it really commercial and add a love story. But I think in this context, you have to remember this is coming from... They're kind of, as far as screenplays, as far as writing goes, they're kind of the most important voice in the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now. So I think what they're really talking about is a sense of continuity. And the fact that they say later that all of the books are different. And I think what they're warning against here is not trying to make a part one, part two, part three unfolding story where everything ties together. And if
like
it's
turning
especially,
a children's book into a major trilogy where each movie is 3 hours long.
Exactly.
That's never happened.
It's never happened before, fortunately. Certainly not in New Zealand. But so I think that's what they're getting at. And if you look at it's especially valid if you look at what the next four books in the series are. Silverchair, Horse and His Boy, Magician's Nephew, Last Battle. Each one is so not only different tonally, but as far as story, they're just very far removed from each other. With the first three in the series, Wardrobe, Caspian, Dawn Treader, there's at least some sense of 1, 2, 3. They each logically flow into the next, even though each one is still a fairly complete story. So I think what they're warning against is trying to... This is what I've been a little spooked by with Joe Johnston's trilogy comment, is trying to form everything in one big package, overarching narrative, and bring everything together. I think that's the main thing they're getting at when they say don't turn it into a franchise. Then really quickly, you know, you threw them under the bus for the Dawn Treader screenplay, and I think it's hard to say who to cast. And again, if you're listening and you like the Dawn Treader film, great, post a comment. Thanks for listening. Rillian and I did not like it, but I think the screenplay was a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So how much they are to blame for the Dawn Treader script, I suspect probably less than people tend to think. And then lastly, it was Apted, not Marcus and McFeely, who said the things about, oh, we've got to add a villain to make it more like Star Wars and Harry Potter.
No, you're right. He was the one who said that. I wasn't trying to attribute it to them.
Right. Okay.
Just
really quick to finish my thought, I would tend to defend them on this and think that what they mean by great big fantasy franchise is not what initially sounds like it means. They're really referring to, hey, I think what they're saying is, and when they say about thoughtful movies later, I think they're also saying this later, embrace the fact that each movie should be its own thing. It should feel very different from the others, and don't try to tie them all together too much. And to their credit, at least with, you know, Wardrobe and Caspian, they embrace that. They embrace the fact that Caspian is very different tonally. They didn't try to make it The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe 2. They embrace the fact that the two books are very different.
Well, there's a couple things going on here which people are reacting to, because much of what they say I do agree with. It's mm-hmm. partly the question of how much baggage do those writers carry with them from the first three films. Uh-huh. And so that kind of conflates with the message that they're giving. And I do agree with what they're saying, but it does bring up another interesting point, and this goes back to, this could become an enormous tangent. We've kind of hit on this in the past, yeah. But there is a discussion of what does unify the Chronicles of Narnia beyond just the character of Aslan and the setting of the world of Narnia. And I think that I think thematically you could certainly...
Well, there are certainly themes that tie them together.
Right. Well, it depends on what themes. And, you know, and I'm hitting on Dr. Ward's book, Planet Narnia, which I think does a really good job of talking about centralized themes. But it is interesting to... I think you could do, regardless, a faithful adaptation of each movie And they're not really talking about the Planet Narnia thing, but in terms of what themes draw, combine the stories or unify the stories, or sure. how much of it is a hodgepodge, is I can't remember his
sure,
name.
No.
I want to give Devin Brown, right?
Devin Brown.
Yeah, Devin Brown defined them as a hodgepodge of stories. And to be sure, each one does have its own unique feel to it. And what their warning is, they're kind of, and pulling from their background, they're coming from the Marvel background, and their warning is something a little different, I think, which is there is this franchise-ness that happens uh-huh. to stories, and it certainly happened to The Hobbit.
And could you define what you mean by franchise really quick? I think that's kind of the heart of people's reaction to this.
I would say it's kind of a cheesy, cheap bigness. That's not very articulate. I don't really know how to.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I see what you're saying, but I don't think that that's what they're saying here. I think they're referring, at least primarily, they're referring to the sense of continuity of it's this big, giant, unfolding thing, this balloon that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I think they're warning against that. And that's what The Green Mist was all about. The Green Mist was all about, we got to introduce The Green Mist into the Dawn Treader movie.
Right.
And then it'll come back as the Lady of the Green Kirtle in the next one. They're trying to tie it all together. And I think what they're saying is, don't worry about that. Embrace the fact that every book is different, and every movie should be kind of feel like its own, have its own beginning, middle, and end, and should also feel like tonally very different from the others. Don't worry about trying to unify it all. And that flies in the face of what you tend to think of with a franchise, which is, people liked this movie. Let's give them another one that's basically exactly the same movie.
Right. Let's have things that open up in one and are concluded in another, and let's tease characters in one, and let's throw in a cameo here. And so maybe when I said cheesy, cheap bigness, that kind of ends up being the result more than the mechanism, perhaps. Because I think that kind of was what was happening with The Green Mist, was it was this, oh my goodness, now all of Narnia is in danger from this. Like, uh-huh. really? That's the point of this? No, it's actually not.
Yeah, I think that that's not, I mean, I agree with that, that that's definitely a risk in a lot of franchises. I just, of trying to raise the stakes super, super high.
Make them different than what they were. Part of the thing was, in some ways, you could argue, because you could say, on one hand, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, one of the failings. And I think a lot of people, I don't think I'm being too critical, I think a lot of people who like the film also criticize this part of it.
Yeah.
On one hand, you could say it raised the stakes. On another hand, you could say it lowered them. Yeah, it cheapened them. It made them more, took away from the transcendent nature of the stakes and made them more imminent. It was all about the here and now. It wasn't about
and
something
it wasn't about the emotional and the more intimate stakes of the book. Mm-hmm. And it's a funny thing in storytelling. Very often, it's a lot easier to care about a couple people we know than the entire world being in danger. And I think they tried to emphasize the entire world being in danger. And so I didn't have with The Green Mist. And so I didn't have nearly the connection I do in the book when it's all about Reepicheep. Is he going to get to the world's end? Are they going to find the Seven Lords, which is Caspian's duty, and what happened to them? And there's other things that the whole world isn't on the line, mm-hmm. but things that are important to the characters that I care about.
Well, and you see this with, and I think that these guys are hitting on something interesting here, because I'll have to now see, now I'm going to watch Infinity War with their comments in the back of my mind. But this does happen to films, and like you said, they're thinking about, the world's at stake. And C.S. Lewis understood that there's a lot of very important things, not all of which just include doom and gloom of, oh my goodness, what if this city gets destroyed? You know, think about, I mean, just look at the news in the media today and look at all the stuff that's making major headlines, and then think about all the very real things in your life that are incredibly important. The relationships that you hold dear, just the normal day-to-day of your family and your friends and what you're pursuing on a day-to-day basis to make the world better. Those things are incredibly important, and it doesn't. It takes a more talented storyteller, I think, to sometimes grasp that.
Yeah,
but
I think that can be a compelling story. And I think that they would agree with you.
I think so.
And towards the end here, when they say you can make a more thoughtful movie of each one, and I think what you're describing is a more thoughtful movie, which is one that is generally a thoughtful movie tends to be more motivated by a few characters we care about rather than the entire world being on the line. And I would agree with him. And it made me start, I was thinking about what would a thoughtful Silver Chair movie look like? And it would basically be, it just really mean, let's just tell a story about Jill and let's not rush past, as an example, I've used this so many times, but that scene where Jill meets Aslan, if they're going to make a thoughtful Silver Chair movie, that's going to be a really long scene. And we're going to get a chance to go, oh, we're going to observe the fact that she's afraid of Aslan, to observe the fact that she's going to have a moment to decide, do I want to go drink the water or not? And we're going to say, oh, she doesn't trust Aslan. And we're going to slowly work that out. If it's a story-driven, the world is on the line, you know, kind of story, that scene's going to be 60 seconds. Aslan's going to give her the four lines and they're going to move on.
It completely changes the takeaway as well. I mean, just think about the emotional takeaway of, say, the line that went to the wardrobe movie from Forge of the Dawn Treader movie. Think about the emotional, like what emotional takeaway is there to the movie Independence Day? I mean, it's a fun movie. I really like the movie. I've watched it over and over again. But yeah, it's like, it's a world is ending movie. And let's go to Marcus and McFeely. You know,
Narnia deserves better than that treatment.
I enjoy most of the Marvel movies. I have my critiques with them.
I do too.
But like,
especially the Captain America movies.
Well, yeah, let's go to the Captain America movies because I was just thinking, you know, if you think about the Captain America story, which is a franchise, is part of a sub-franchise of a bigger franchise. You know, my bigger takeaway from the Captain America stories isn't each time he saves America or the world from a certain danger.
Uh-huh.
Actually, my bigger takeaway is the character's journey and questions he asks about what role he should have in the world.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I go to that because that's a script, the scripts that they wrote. And
I think that's the secret to Marvel's success is that not all the time, but at least a lot of the time, they do manage to balance the bigness and the world being on the line with, but not losing sight of what the characters are going through and the thing that we can grab onto and relate to and have a more emotional stake in. They generally don't overlook that. And again, I think that Narnia should transcend what Marvel's trying to do. I think Narnia deserves a better treatment than that, but I think that is an aspect of it that they should focus on with the Silver Chair is make it more. This isn't about, you know, save the world and woo, and then we're done. I get to go home. I think you should walk out.
Underworld was defeated.
Exactly. You should walk out thinking about things. And so there's a question too of who's to. It's funny. We tend to think of Marcus and McFeely as being, like a lot of people say, you know, the scripts were, I think Skillet Dude said this in the comments, the scripts were one of the main problems with the first three Narnia movies that were kind of lackluster.
True.
And I think Skillet Dude actually said they kind of got worse as they went along. And most people tend to agree that, yeah, they're okay, but they weren't great. But they're kind of separating themselves out here from that and maybe casting blame on others. First off, they say, Marcus says, they're going to be in trouble if they, like other people, feel they can turn this into a great big fantasy franchise.
Yeah,
and then later he says, you can make a thoughtful movie, and that would be great if the people were prepared to do that. So you almost get the sense that it wasn't my idea, you know, to do that. To
almost like a parting shot off the bow.
it feels like that.
I thought about that, but
so it kind of feels like they're casting blame there a little bit. And you do get the sense that there was a lot of pressure to make Narnia a lot like Lord of the Rings. That's not surprising.
I will say this. The biggest common denominator between all three movie scripts was Marcus and McFeely. But if you look at how vastly different they were on so many levels.
That's true. I mean, to me, it's Wardrobe and Caspian are one thing, and then Dawn Treader is another thing. With Wardrobe and Caspian, you had, now granted, I think they
and
were
Peacock
trying to.
Left for Prince Caspian.
Yeah. And Peacock was the first screenwriter to be hired, and then it kind of got taken over. But
my point is that even with them being a common denominator, you see vast differences.
Sure.
So it's not.
But for me, it's like you've got Wardrobe and Caspian in one hand, which is, I think that was made as a reaction to Lord of the Rings. And so you could say their ambitions aren't that high in that sense. They were just kind of trying to make a spiritual sequel to Lord of the Rings. But they did have Andrew Adamson in the driver's seat. And while I don't think he understood all the nuances of the books, I think he really liked them. And I think he's a decent filmmaker. So what we got are pretty, what I would say are pretty good, but not great movies. They're pretty good. Then you got to Don Treader, and in my opinion, again, just my opinion, if you're listening and like Don Treader, appreciate that, please post a comment. But in my opinion, there was no sense of vision at all of what they were supposed to do next. They knew, well, we got to make it more like the first movie. I guess that was more successful, and I guess we got to add a villain to make it more like Harry Potter.
Quick,
and
put there snow was no, in there.
Yeah, but and emphasize that in all the trailers.
Snowing on the beach. What's good?
So I don't think of Marcus and McFeely as being like the thing that brought down Don Treader. I don't think of them as being the common denominator. I guess I think of the circumstances as being the thing that kind of differentiates the different movies. I'm not saying I agree with every decision Marcus and McFeely made with the script for Prince Caspian, obviously, but credit the fact that they didn't make The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe 2. They did embrace the fact that this is a very different story. It would have been easy to try to make it a lot more like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe tonally, and they didn't do that. And I think you've got to give them in the studio some credit for that.
Yeah.
Would you say, they also say Silverchair is the most cinematic Narnia book because it has a quest narrative. What are your thoughts on that?
It is a road trip story, which does lend itself very well to film. The Fellowship of the Ring is easily the one that lends itself to the film easiest. I think of Lord of the Rings. I think The Horse and His Boy and The Silver Chair of the remaining films would be the easiest to do. I don't know if I'd
horse
say
and his boy. You have some big technical challenges with The Horse and His Boy, with the talking horses interacting with children. Being hard to visualize, but as a story,
I don't know that. I mean, this has some interesting dynamics with the Marshwiggles and the giants, and then the how you do a good job with the suspense on the prince, and then there's each offers its own challenges.
But overall, I don't think we're
a lot of times when you say what's the most cinematic, you also have kind of a connotation in your mind. You know, depending on the type of director you brought along, when I think about, The Magician's Nephew, I'm thinking about films like Finding Neverland, which, just to the parallel of a mother of children passing away. I mean, that's a very different type of story there, which certainly could be done, but it would take almost a different breed of director, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think cinematic too often, especially when a lot of the Narnia filmmakers have used it, they tend to use it basically to mean commercial. Cinematic, like how similar to Lord of the Rings is it? I don't know what they mean by cinematic here, but yeah, you look at the remaining books, certainly rule out The Last Battle. What are they going to do with that as a movie? I have no idea. I guess I just tend to mean visual, basically. And a quest journey is something that's very easy to visualize because we know what the characters want and we know what they're doing. We don't usually have to explain what they're doing. It's very clear.
The story structure works well.
Yeah.
As opposed to, say, Prince Caspian, which jumps back and forth.
We knew Silverchair very early on. Like, we knew with Prince Caspian, wow, that's going to be a challenge to do Prince Caspian. We knew that from the beginning. With Silverchair, there's not much. There are some things I'm sure we'll get into as the movie news is coming out and we're analyzing it. But there's nothing that jumps out at you immediately as, wow, how are they going to do that? So I think that's kind of what they're referring to. It lends itself a little more easy to be in a movie than the others. Doesn't mean it'll be the best movie or anything, but oftentimes the best movies come out of trying to do something that just feels impossible. That's how you get the most original material.
Mm-hmm.
But Silverchair,
done it this way before. How can we come up with ways to do this?
Exactly. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. Cool. Let's take a quick break for Voices of Narnia Web and C.S. Lewis Minute, and then maybe I'll be getting stumped. We'll see. We'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hello, Narnia Web. This is Erevisa 10th, and my journey to Narnia began in 1998 when the Focus on the Family radio drama came out with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I've read the books a couple years before the first film came out, and the film itself, the first one, while I generally like Prince Caspian more in pretty much every way, acting, characters, even the direction seems a little more clear in Caspian than Wardrobe. It's still a really well done film. Out of all the books I would have to say Horson's voice is my favorite. Just because it does hold a very special place in my heart. At that time when I was going through a whole lot of things that almost every teenager goes through. When it's near that point when you're about to leave for college or career, whatever you're planning on doing. And just wondering, you know, I should have purpose outside of here, but at this point I don't know what it would be. Just that message came through to me most. Favorite character, if you couldn't tell by my name, is Erephis. She has a lot to lose. The only Narnian that comes from royalty and has a chance to still be royalty, because Caspian is gonna die if he stays there, so that's what separates him. I still say that the entire series overall still has a very special place for me.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Previously, I mentioned The Abolition of Man, a short book that is not an easy read. One of its key themes was objective right and wrong, which is initially dealt with in another of Lewis's titles that many consider a classic. Mere Christianity is the name of that book. However, it is not actually a single book, but a collection of three titles previously released. Mere Christianity originally came out in 1952, the same year The Voyage of the Dawn Treader was released. But it combined much shorter works that were mostly collections of talks Lewis gave on the radio in England in the 1940s. The helpful information and advice found in Mere Christianity has been enjoyed by countless individuals over the years and is well worth a read or reread. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
It's time to stump a Narnia Webber.
Okay, what color is the White Witch's hair? Will you answer the question or blow Queen Susan's horn and take a hint?
So it's not black, because it's black in the Pauline Baynes illustrations, and I think the animated version it was black as well, and for that reason everyone assumed it was black. I'm quite confident that it's not, her hair color is not described in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I remember when the movie came out and her hair was blonde, and some people went, "What? The White Witch's hair is black!" And then they kind of read the book and went, "Oh, I guess I just always assumed it was." I really liked your blonde hair, so that was really cool. And I like the dreads. Made her feel more like a creature. But in the books, what color is her hair? It's not, I'm pretty sure it's not described in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe book. So it's a question of, is it described in The Magician's Nephew? And I'm pretty sure it's not, simply because I know this is a thing. I've had a lot of discussions with fans where they say, oh, everyone assumes her hair is black, and it's not. But I don't think it says it's blonde. So I'm going to go ahead and say that her hair color is never described in the book.
Is that your final answer?
I'm gonna say this is sort of a trick question here. Yep, that is my final answer.
You are correct. It's never specified in the books.
Oh, I was trying to sound confident, but it's really like,
okay.
Because the question was, what color was her hair? I'm like, well, do we know then? And I remembered, Shasta's twin. Oh, it's got to be a trick question. Definitely. Oh, from the likes of Shasta's twin. It could only
Shasta's
be a trick question.
Shasta's twin trying to boil him.
Cool. All righty. Let's wrap this up. As a reminder, Prince Caspian Watch Party is coming out, or will be this weekend, Saturday, May 12th at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Have live stump questions ready. And really quick before we go, I want to plug a new Narnia podcast. Have you listened to this yet, Rillian?
I have not.
I figured you hadn't. That's why I asked you, so you'd be embarrassed. So there's a new podcast called The Lamppost Listener.
Welcome to The Lamppost Listener. My name is Daniel.
And I'm Phil.
and this is a podcast where we will be journeying chapter by chapter through C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. Our goal is for listeners to be able to enjoy visiting Narnia, whether this is your first or 50th time.
In the first season of our show, we are going to be reading through The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe. And we should probably go ahead and admit up front that we are by no means Narnia experts. In fact, you might even say that we are Narnia novices.
Honestly, that might be a better name for our show, because I expect many of our listeners will know much more than we do. But that's okay, because our intention with the show is not to take a comprehensive approach to the series. But instead, we want to discover Narnia slowly, one chapter at a time, the same way a first-time reader would.
What's kind of neat is they're going through The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe right now. So we're in the middle of our horse and his boy discussion. So we're almost on opposite ends of the series here. And it's really exciting to see a new Narnia podcast on the scene. And hey, these books, I think, are criminally underrated. And the more attention we can draw to them, the better. So again, that's called The Lamppost Listener. I'll include a link in the description. Please consider subscribing.
They are also on Twitter.
That is correct. They've got Facebook as well. And they're just up and about. All right.
Okay, now here's the real question. Here's the real Stump Glumpuddle question. Can you get through the outro in one take without flubbing it?
You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcasts@NarniaWeb.com, Rillian@NarniaWeb.com, or Glumpuddle@NarniaWeb.com. Special thanks to AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest Narnia movie news, visit NarniaWeb.com. A new episode of Talking Beasts is posted every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.
Go!
I mean, I wrote it, so I hope I would get it.